Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live on WBAI. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 70,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. The latest crisis of capitalism is intensifying as coronavirus continues to wreak havoc on human life and break down the machinery of competitive accumulation. A mass wave of evictions is barreling our way to unleash widespread suffering unless the working class organizes and fights back. Join us as we speak with NYC DSA organizers Hind, Tiffany, and Alex on their efforts to build networks of mutual and community defense to prepare for the impending struggle against predatory landlords and their fascist goon squad, the NYPD. Later, we're joined by Ginger to hear about the struggle against her landlord's illegal effort to evict her from her home. But first, the headlines with Simone Norman.
The city is bracing for mass evictions after the failure of New York's rent relief program. As pushback grows against the state and city's plans to reopen schools in the fall, some officials have called for reopening to be delayed until later in the year. The Movement of Rank-and-File Educators, a leftist rank-and-file caucus within the United Federation of Teachers, is discussing the possibility of a teacher sick-out to protest reopening. New York State rent regulation is based on a decades-old definition of a housing emergency defined as a 5% or lower apartment vacancy rate. The vacancy rate is currently suspected to be growing as households leave the city due to the pandemic. State Senator Brad Hoyleman of the East Village and Assemblymember Harvey Epstein, also of the East Village, introduced a bill to protect rent-regulated units by pausing the vacancy count until 2 years after the city's COVID-19 emergency declaration has ended. Landlord-run groups have forcefully opposed the legislation. Council Speaker Corey Johnson has seemingly retaliated against Vocal New York for the group's role in last month's budget protests by canceling city funding for a new headquarters for the homeless and HIV/AIDS advocacy organization. An 18-year-old protest leader was thrown into an unmarked van and arrested by plainclothes police officers. The NYPD lied about the incident. The Queens, Bronx, and Staten Island district attorneys have said they may choose not to prosecute police officers under a new city law that prohibits police officers from sitting or kneeling on a suspect. Following the repeal of 50A, the law that prevented police officers' records from being available to the public, ProPublica has compiled and released a database of complaints against NYPD police officers. Newly released data from the Civilian Complaint Review Board show that 1 in 9 police officers have a confirmed record of misconduct. Governor Cuomo stated that unless the federal government sends aid to the state, New York may have to increase tolls and transit fares to compensate for the state's almost $13 billion budget shortfall. As Cuomo resists calls from the state legislature to raise taxes on the wealthy, The Guardian reports that over one-third of New York's billionaires have donated to the governor. In a move against Cuomo, State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and State Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie have voiced their support for increasing taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers. NYCHA Chair Greg Russ announced a plan to transfer ownership of two-thirds of its apartments to a new city-owned corporation, which would contract back to NYCHA to provide maintenance and management. Governor Cuomo announced a relaunch of the state's census efforts, which includes some limited field work. The state's compliance rate currently lags behind the national average, which could lead to the loss of federal funding and congressional representation. And in election news, Maya Wiley, former board chair of the CCRB and counsel to Mayor de Blasio, is stepping down from her current job at MSNBC to run for mayor in 2021. This year's election of six open socialists to the state legislature is the first time there will be such a bloc in Albany in 100 years, when as many as 10 socialists held power following the 1917 election. Gothamist covered the collapse of machine power within the Bronx County Democratic Party over the past 2 years, which prior to 2018 had one of the most disciplined and powerful party machines in the city.
Our weekly headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So yesterday, I was joined by Hind, Tiffany, and Alex for a kind of wide-ranging discussion on the impending waves of evictions, as well as the networks of community defense, mutual aid that have, and as well as tenants' unions that have arisen both over the past few years and increasingly so since the coronavirus has wreaked havoc on our city, the country, and the whole world. And before we get to this interview, I really want to emphasize what is a crucial point if we really think about this in terms of political economy and the kind of class alliances that have maintained the neoliberal order over the past 50 years, that this fictitious capital accumulation that became really widespread in the 80s through this mass suburbanization and this transfer from the kind of mass consumption of the New Deal period to an overconsumption within the upper middle class strata. And that within this framework, these kind of new real estate overlords became increasingly important in a political economy that became about accumulation of financial assets. And in order to protect this order, the police have gotten more and more power. So now let's play this interview from yesterday that I did with Hind, Tiffany, and Alex on the struggle against this impending wave of evictions once the moratorium is lifted. So let's play that clip, Reggie. Thank you. So I just want to give our three guests the chance to introduce themselves. So Hind, I'll ask you first, what forces propelled you into the movement for socialism? Why did you get involved with DSA in particular? And what sort of what's your organizing history? What are the sort of struggles that you have especially been involved in?
So my DSA origin story, like many people, started with electoral organizing. As a woman of color, and a first-generation immigrant, I've never really seen myself in represented in our government or represented in our media in any kind of way, especially as an Arab woman, as anything other than a terrorist. So when AOC's campaign first started what I call the millennial wave of socialist organizing, I hopped on that bandwagon. And as soon as her campaign was over, it felt like all the work suddenly stopped the day she won, and all the issues kind of fell away. So that is really what radicalized me the most as an organizer, was seeing what happens at the end of an electoral campaign and all the work that's still left to be done when they win or lose.
The question of what is to be done after electoral campaign is absolutely key. So Tiffany, how about the same questions as I asked Hind?
Yeah, so I'm also a woman of color, Queens born and raised. I got radicalized back in 2008 during the subprime mortgage collapse, and first became active within the DSA, honestly, during COVID lockdown. So once protests started up around the BLM and George Floyd rebellion, I came along to one of their events outside of Daniel Drum's home and was really, really impressed with how organized they were with their tactics. And I immediately got as involved as possible. Prior to that, I was doing as much as I can working in Astoria Mutual Aid Network and then got linked up with Queens DSA Mutual Aid Network, which feels very much like a political home to me now. And yeah, I think it's a great organization as a broad left project. I'm significantly to the left of the DSA as, you know, a political ideology, but that's like sort of future planning in terms of today orientation, allowing material conditions to dictate policy. I think the DSA is where it's at, and it's filled with really great people.
The 2008 crisis was definitely a moment for a lot of people, particularly in our generation, that really kind of broke down the facade of capitalism is functioning well for the majority, even though before that it wasn't either. But I think that was a really kind of a shattering moment. And that protest really highlighted, that you mentioned, really highlighted the differences between like liberal politicians, what they think is acceptable, and the tactics and strategies of like building power for socialism that are absolutely distinct. So Alex, the same questions directed towards you.
Yeah. So I spent probably like a decade or so as an unorganized, disaffected socialist until like Occupy and then get into Bernie's first campaign. And I joined DSA right after, basically after he lost that primary. And I spent a little time getting my feet. And when the Queens branch started, the housing working group is where I finally found my home and helped build that up. And so I've been involved in the housing working group since probably late 2017, I would say. And I just finally ended my, like 2.5 years on the OC there. So I finally don't have any more OC duties in Queens housing and can work on a lot of other stuff. I also organize in the Libertarian Socialist Caucus. And so that's kind of like my other home within this home, I guess you could say. So within housing, you know, we've launched a bunch of different projects. No Amazon HQ2 stuff was really big for us. And then, you know, when the pandemic hit, we launched the Queens DSA Mutual Aid from the housing working group, which kind of brings us to today's conversation a little bit. In some of those the prior months, a bunch of comrades in Queens, Hind included, started a dual power working group. And that's kind of been an incubator for what I think we'd consider like community defense projects. And we made a big collective decision between housing and dual power that like mutual aid would be better fit in dual power and move things over there. And it really just took off and has become an entity unto its own. And it's been really wonderful to see. And it allows us to interact in different ways and bring different people on board, which I think is like what everyone wanted from that.
That sort of organizing that has been occurring over the past few years before coronavirus obviously has become even more important now, because while housing is a permanent crisis under capitalism and renters face the highest burden of this crisis, it has been intensified and accelerated by the economic collapse that has occurred. And while there's been this moratorium on evictions, it hasn't kind of come to the fore yet, but there are millions of New Yorkers who are unable to pay their rent. This is something that is occurring across the country, where you're seeing kind of shocking numbers of percentage of people who will be evicted once the moratoriums are lifted, and if there isn't organization and struggle to protect these people against the brutality of the landlords. So how is this kind of organization and struggle that has occurred in these years built up? How has this prepared DSA and other comrades in the struggle for tenants' rights for this impending wave of evictions? How are organizers going to defend tenants in this struggle? So, Alex, can you explain like what the strategy and tactics is going to be like for this upcoming struggle?
This is something that people have been preparing for a long time. It still hasn't made the act of organizing any easier. You know, for months and months, both, you know, us in Queens and then in the housing working groups in the other parts of the city have been trying to organize tenants. There are a handful of tenants' unions. Some have been around for a long time. Others are small. There's new ones forming. But as far as like trying to organize tenants, it can be really difficult because people know that there's problems. But until you have some sort of real crisis that hits home for a lot of people, it's hard to get people motivated to actually take action. There needs to be some kind of material pull to organize around so that it doesn't feel theoretical or abstract to people. That really hit us during the No Amazon stuff when, you know, we're trying to get our housing work off the ground and then suddenly this thing comes in and then displacement and gentrification really hits home for a lot of people, especially for people in DSA where there's a lot of complexity around the like individual members and members collectively, like what their place in gentrification is, and how it's a systemic problem. As far as this pandemic now and people not being able to pay rent, I think there's a number of nonprofits in the city who have been doing this work for you know, years, and, you know, tenants unions. I'm in my neighborhood, I'm in the Ridgewood Tenants Union, which is an autonomous tenant union, just brilliant organizers here who know their stuff. And really it's getting neighbors to talk to each other and recognize that it's a collective struggle and not everybody and people aren't alone in this. Everybody's starting to understand that they are affected by this crisis. So there's a number of different avenues that people are taking. For one, some unions have been, you know, organizing for rent strikes even prior to this because of other issues in their buildings or with their landlords. Now it's a simple thing of like, no one's able to pay. How do you pay when, you know, you're not making enough, you're not working at all. Maybe you're getting some kind of unemployment, but now a lot of those benefits are running out or have expired this past month. For a lot of undocumented people around the city, they haven't gotten any benefits. And so they're really at risk right now of being targeted by their landlords, by other, you know, by other predators, like in their neighborhoods, things like that. I think the thing is that's where mutual aid comes in, right? And looking at evictions as something that we need to defend our communities against. I know that's been big in my neighborhood, in the surrounding areas that have been hit by gentrification, and really it's an issue across the city. So preparing tenants for what happens during an eviction and getting them to understand their rights, because a lot of people just don't know their rights in housing, their rights as tenants, where they have them. I think that's one of the biggest hurdles that we have to initially overcome as we start to prepare for this. I think beyond that, there's issues of legal versus illegal evictions. And a lot of the established, you know, institutions, organizations are working with people, working with tenants on how do you prepare for an eviction that goes to the courts, right? That's what we're thinking about now. You know, the courts, if they open back up when this eviction moratorium ends, there's going to be a flood with landlords putting in, you know, claims to get tenants out. I think I heard the number something like there's already 70,000 some odd like claims in the housing courts that predate the crisis. This is something that's going to stretch out for a long time. It might give tenants time to prepare with their neighbors, with you know, an established organization or create a new one on their own, which everyone is capable of doing, and try to create a strategy that works for them in their building, maybe on their block, in their neighborhood. But that's for legal evictions. And so we're also worried about illegal evictions, which is when a landlord just bypasses the courts and basically terrorizes tenants into leaving in one form or another, because people don't necessarily know their rights. So someone gets a note that says, oh, eviction, oh, you have to leave. They think it's legitimate and it's not. They can stay where they are. But a lot of people don't know that. And that's a problem that we're seeing already. We've already had a couple instances of illegal evictions happening that have kind of made news already. There was one a few weeks ago in Crown Heights where a noted landlord came in and just kind of moved his stuff into a place that he had converted and people were still living in. And the neighborhood showed up through basically kind of like a phone tree and social media. The tenants unions were out. I think it was Crown Heights Tenants Union. I think Equality for Flatbush and some other people. I mean, DSA people were down there. And it made news and people just gathered and they made a blockade. So a blockade is something that, you know, we're trying to learn about within, you know, DSA housing for people who are just learning about this stuff. But we're also trying to teach tenants about that, how to strategize for that, and use it as a tactic that has worked. You know, New York is a little different than other cities, but we're seeing, I don't know, you see on social media, I think there's been stuff in DC, in New Orleans, I think maybe in some other cities where people have just literally blockaded the court itself so that people couldn't go in and file claims. Whether that becomes a thing that happens here remains to be seen. Basically every tactic is on the table right now, because it has to be.
That's a really perfect way of putting it, that you can't really hold back in this moment. I was down on Dean Street during that struggle that took place during that illegal eviction. I spent a little bit of time there, and it was, one, incredible to see the solidarity of the community showing up and defending one of their own. That was very impressive and encouraging to see. And I think you also mentioned what had gone down in New Orleans, the defending, the kind of picket line that formed outside the courthouse to not let the landlords in. And the strength and solidarity that was shown in that moment is something that's going to be absolutely necessary going forward if we're going to avoid the worst consequences of this immediate crisis and also needed for building working class power.
But first, I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can also find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about the fight against this mass wave of evictions and how it relates to the anti-fascist struggle.
If Alex really kind of laid the terrain there really well, but is there anything that you want to more further elaborate on? Like, what are the role of kind of like neighborhood networks or possible squatting in individual apartments or entire buildings? What role do these sort of tactics and strategies have in the movement going forward?
Well, I'm very much oriented into these mutual aid networks that I think will be critical in terms of drumming up support and creating blockades and showing up to one another's, you know, evictions. So for me personally, I've taken it upon myself to look into adverse possession laws and squatters' rights, which actually we're pretty uniquely well positioned in New York State for them. That's partly because of history of squatters movements in decades past. So things like Operation Move in the 1970s, where a group of activists, mostly Black and Latino, took over like 7 buildings in Morningside Heights and held them down for several years in order to build up community infrastructure that they desperately needed. I actually can't think of a better time to really evoke those same sentiments and those same tactics now, since we're looking at over 40% of New York renters facing eviction, 1 in 5 facing food insecurity. I mean, that's like societal collapse numbers that we don't have the time to wait on several election cycles before the community needs can be met. In the meantime, the structural violence and the economic alienation is like wreaking havoc upon the community. So I think it's going to be a really difficult decision for a lot of people as to how they would like to engage with tactics in terms of protecting their homes and keeping a roof over their heads. Not all of it strictly legal, but you know, I think that if you're really facing that kind of desperation, I'm not entirely sure what it is that is expected of you in response to something like that, to be facing those kinds of challenges. We have a mercifully gracious amount of time in order to be able to lay claim to a property if you are trying to squat somewhere. In the United States, squatters' rights in terms of like claiming adverse possession can start from as low as 5 years in some states and as high as 40 years in others, which is almost a lifetime. That's crazy. But in New York State, it's 10. I think also we are uniquely positioned in the sense that there are so many vacant properties. And certainly a huge part of the alienation that we're seeing on this front, at least in terms of the momentum that was like brought up from before COVID, right, is this like force of gentrification sort of pushing people out of these communities and pushing people into tighter and tighter living situations while plenty of properties remain completely vacant. And there are many unhoused people now. One of the tactics that I'm looking into this week, I'm trying to meet with property managers and people who are plugged into property management in New York City in general to look for vacant properties that are essentially just places for foreign investment to park their money, right? One of the strongest tactics that ownership class uses in order to push squatters out is to have the owner show up to a property that is being occupied. In order for the 10-year clock to start and to run out in order to claim adverse possession, the clock starts all over again if ownership shows up onto the property at any point. If you target certain properties where it's very difficult for ownership to come to the property in the middle of a public health crisis, that's actually probably working in our favor, right? Travel is considerably more challenging now. And there are other like really creative solutions that I think that, you know, the minds within the DSA can also come up with. And yeah, it's also a mechanism by which a lot of people have taken over plots of land for guerrilla gardening as well. So another tactic is to beautify or maintain the property, which is a signal within the judicial system of ownership, of legitimate ownership. It's an exciting time as well as a terrifying one.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that kind of legal loopholes, perhaps, that will be very helpful for many of our listeners going forward in this struggle. And I think it's really crucial that you note, in a certain sense, one, the absurdity of how housing is currently structured in New York, where you have this massive level of homelessness, all these people out there struggling on the streets, many of whom have, at least prior to the crisis, were working too. And it's just housing is so expensive in this city that they couldn't afford to go anywhere. Well, at the same time, you have hundreds of thousands of vacant units and units that are owned by like international capital who have no use for them except for accumulating more and more fictitious financial capital, and that our entire system has become based on this. But I guess in a certain sense, this is, as you described, open up a strategic opportunity because of the particular circumstances of the crisis that we're going through right now. And Hind, I want to transition these questions towards you right now, because I think this struggle in housing. And Tiffany and Alex, I believe, both mentioned mutual aid and the kind of thinking of this as both as this struggle as a process of mutual aid, but also in these past few months, you've had these mutual aid networks really kind of blossom and develop, helping people survive through the coronavirus pandemic. So in those terms, like, what role can those mutual aid networks play in the struggle going forward? What is like the relationship between mutual aid and community defense? And then kind of beyond that, thinking about how, when it comes to at least legal evictions, that the police are the armies for real estate capital in this city. They will be the ones enforcing these laws. They will be the ones pulling people out of their homes. And as our listeners are well aware, we've been going through the longest and most widespread struggle against police violence and for Black lives in this country that we've ever seen. How can these struggles be connected? And what is the role of something like NYCDSA's Defund the NYPD campaign in this struggle against evictions?
The way I look at it, mutual aid is about framing what community looks like in Western society, where we've been really isolated from one another. There's a lot of cultures and communities and historically entire societies where being enmeshed in your community and your family and your social structure is exactly what has always been done to keep yourself alive. But now that we're living in what is essentially a global westernized place where American and Western culture are very dominant, even outside of the West, we've had to kind of pick apart what it means to take care of one another and take care of our society. So mutual aid really describes the process by which we demonetize and consider community care without an exchange of money as being necessary for someone having their needs met. So in many ways, I think it's over-intellectualized that we have to think about it in that way. But also it's an exciting moment to see that in a global crisis, people are coming together to take care of each other and are very invested in learning more about what it means to have a mutual aspect to caretaking as opposed to a more transactional relationship, which is often what is necessitated by a capitalist state. All of that kind of jargon aside, what we first did, as Alex mentioned earlier, in March, when the pandemic started and when we started hearing the rumblings from Cuomo about his New York State on Pause executive order, how the Housing Working Group in Queens put out this volunteer list to get people engaged in thinking about mutual aid and taking care of each other. From there, we have at this point in Queens DSA, I'm beyond proud to say, like, we've been consistently feeding hundreds of families, and we've engaged a couple hundred volunteers. We're working with a lot of different churches and community groups and other mutual aid networks across the city. And I've personally met like an incredible amount of organizers who I don't think many of them would even call themselves organizers, all coalescing around this concept that it is important to consider mutuality when we consider care. That being said, the way I look at the crisis in terms of housing and accessibility to basic necessities like food and shelter and just safety. In this capitalist state, we can't have access to any of that without money. And what we're trying to do, at least when we're considering building a mutual aid network or working towards a structure that is truly mutual, we're trying to build systems where we're demonetizing at the beginning, we were just buying people groceries and then giving them money to get those groceries, because that's what the conditions necessitated. From there, we started working to find folks who would just donate us large amounts of food. And Evangel Church was one of those places. Even the Queensborough president's office started getting huge amounts of donations and just handing them out at parking lots to whoever would show up, including various mutual aid networks like ours. And with Eviction Defense, part of what happened during us building out our mutual aid networks is that we just built, like Alex said, these phone trees and text trees and just modes of communicating with one another, so that when a crisis did occur, we could go ahead and send 40, 50, even 60 people in the middle of the night to Dean Street. And that was incredible, just to see that we were able to do something like that. It's certainly not the first time anything like that has ever been done, but in our lifetimes, for us to see something like that in the middle of a pandemic, I thought was extremely powerful. So the way I look at Eviction Defense is, I'm taking care of my neighbor because I would want my neighbor to take care of me if this happened. You know, it's, I'm not expecting anything in return, other than this exchange of care and ideas that, you know, I'm showing up because this is what I would expect. It's kind of a beautiful and simple thing that a lot of us tend to forget when we're told to look at every stranger like they're evil and bad and could hurt us, which is also a capitalist notion, right? Is to divide and conquer. If we're not friends with each other and we don't talk to our neighbors, then we can't, you know, rise up against the fascist state. And you're absolutely right that when we think about mutual aid and organizing in general, that it needs to be anti-racist. I think in the past few years or since I've joined DSA, I've been lucky enough to see a lot of successful campaigns, and we've been able to do a lot in terms of base building and growing what socialism looks like, but we haven't necessarily ensured that all the work that we do is anti-racist, whether we are growing our organization and seeking new members or onboarding them, or, you know, thinking about issue campaigns like public power. We don't necessarily go out of our way or even have the tools as leaders in NYCDSA to say that we are necessarily an abolitionist organization. However, this moment that's presented itself in the last few months has really forced us to step up and reevaluate our priorities in a way that I don't think would have been possible outside of this pandemic. And we did kick off the NYPD campaign basically around the end of May, when all the protests started. We essentially, actually with most of the work was done by some Emerge comrades, and a lot of other DSA members came together to put together phone trees and check-ins and jail support and just the mutual aid necessary to keep our soldiers safe in the streets, because this is a class war and we've got people who were arrested, like myself, and I don't think I ever imagined in my life someone as being, you know, upper middle class and white passing, and generally, you know, I can talk my way out of a ticket with a cop or something because I'm very light. Like, I never imagined that the conditions would present themselves for someone, quote unquote, like me to ever be arrested. And here we are in the middle of what feels like a proxy war. So that's how the defund campaign originally started, out of trying to take care of our comrades in the streets who were organizing actions and protests and were camping out at Abolition Square and doing all of that kind of work. The very first day, we just showed up with water bottles and masks and gloves and started handing them out. Next thing you know, we've got thousands of people signing in on our check-in forms asking, you know, have you seen this person? Have you called them? Like, getting people rides in the middle of the night when the mayor blocked cabs from getting protesters. I think it was from getting protesters, but they said it was for safety reasons. But the fact that we could still get each other rides within 10 minutes just from texting each other without spending any money, without, you know, parting with our capital, was incredible. And it really did show us that we can keep each other safe if we simply put in the time to try to build those connections with each other. Basically, it originally started with the fight to push city council to vote no on the budget on June 30th for fiscal year 2021. Most of us did expect it to pass, but really we just wanted to publicize the process as much as people and build a political sentiment among the public and just do political education in general. And now we're really focused on, in the next 4 months, housing courts reopening. As we've been talking about, eviction defense is going to be really necessary, but also political education around the need for it. We're also organizing around schools reopening in September, putting mostly working class families at risk, and including our own children, which is insane to me. We're also organizing around the 22,000 anticipated layoffs of municipal city workers in October, as well as the new cadet class for NYPD in October. So those are kind of the four big areas that we're trying to focus on in the next few months, with the main goal being to bring together all of the working groups across NYCDSA, make sure that they have a clear sense of what anti-racist organizing looks like and what it really means in this moment if we want to capitalize on what's going on right now in the current conditions, and building a space within DSA where we're not siloed, because often we don't really know what's happening in other parts of the organization. We don't always care to create the structures to help us communicate with one another. So the goal of the Defund campaign is to provide a home for abolitionist organizing and education, not just within the left in NYC, but within DSA, so that we can become better organizers in the future as well.
What you just laid out there in terms of these struggles that are ahead, as well as the kind of networks of solidarity that emerged right as the struggle burst to the surface in late May, the fusion of those two things, can that come together, this network of solidarity that was out in their streets, can this continue to push forward to be central to these impending struggles, is absolutely something that we want to keep our eyes on here at Revolutions Per Minute. And Tiffany, I know you wanted to add a couple of thoughts to this before we head out.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a little bit of waxing poetic on how awesome I think mutual aid is. So we have this like really beautiful electoral machine within the DSA that runs progressive candidates, right? And planning political actions that are extremely powerful and are getting a lot of support and attention. And then on the other hand, it's like mutual aid is the other hand of that, that's doing the quiet, thankless, oftentimes unglamorous coalition building, where you really just get in there and you meet your neighbors and you try to meet their needs and you try and do what you can. I see mutual aid in like, you know, the Kropotkin sense of sort of like a weaponized network of friendship, right? So if we're showing up for one another, it is, you know, a extremely powerful way to address power. We're super excited about what we're building here. In terms of a diversity of thought, a diversity of tactics, and being celebratory about that, you know, not trying to all be on the same page about everything.
Absolutely. I think a diversity of tactics is so crucial in this moment, and us building power in so many different sites of struggle so that you can fuse all of these struggles together, but not from a top-down sense, but through the bottom, meeting people's needs and kind of politicizing people through these various different spaces, whether it is mutual aid or, you know, people have met, like the electoral victories, I think were important for people to engage in, but it's not more important than this mutual aid work. And without this mutual aid work, then you're not really building the relationships necessary to get after and kind of undermine what Hind was talking about before, this kind of dominance of this kind of Western individualist ideology that is so crucial to reinforcing the regime of competitive accumulation that is destroying like the future life on Earth at this moment, and is also kind of at the core of this fascist ideology that is reemerging with a new potency in America in this day and age, that is really encapsulated by, I'd say, both the police, these also kind of the extensions of the police state in the federal government that you see out in Portland, this death cult of capital that is really tied into industries like real estate that are so detached from workers and just only can only really see accumulation as the end goal of life, which in its own essence is a racist philosophy, because this whole structure has been built upon the particularly accumulating wealth for white people. So any final thoughts or events that any of the three of you want to highlight, particularly related to the anti-fascist struggle and how it relates to these various struggles that we're living through at the moment?
I think the big thing, and this is the big thing I learned by being an unorganized socialist for a long time, is joining something, whether or not it's the DSA. Find out if there's a tenant union, or start one with your neighbors. That thing is huge. You know, if you want to plug into things, regardless of, you know, what borough you're in, you know, if you're in Queens, email queens.housing@socialist.nyc. We can try to get you plugged in to, you know, people near you, whatever organizations, or help you get things started on your own. There's a big thing coming up for a newish formation within our chapter of anti-fascists. And there's a big event coming up on August 22nd. And one of the great things about this, it's going to be an anti-fascism open house, and multiple issue-based groups are going to be participating. So there's going to be all kinds of different ways for people to plug in and see how these issues intersect with one another. And people can find their home within this movement. I think that's the thing that keeps people at bay sometimes, is they're like, all these things are huge and interconnected, and where do you pick one? And sometimes you're just going to be like, all right, I'm going to do this. And then you start to see that, like, there's all these comrades around who are going to work on other things, and the work just like flows and, you know, new properties emerge out of that, which is really beautiful. But if, you know, write this down, bit.ly/A22 open house. That'll get you the info for the anti-fascist open house on August 22nd. That could be really huge, because, you know, this eviction moratorium is going to end a couple days before that on the 20th. We don't really know what's going to happen. One of the big ways, I think, like, get involved in housing, get involved in anti-fascism. I was just at a housing march on Saturday, and there were Patriot Front stickers up, you know, on poles in Glendale in Queens, which is not far from me. So, you know, people have been fighting, you know, neo-Nazis, fascists in the city for the past, I don't even know how long, you know, that's the people in Brooklyn, in Staten Island, in the Bronx, in Queens, we've been fighting them. They're here. They're not scared of it anymore.
We're actually having an onboarding meeting tomorrow for anyone who's interested in getting involved in the defund campaign. If you are committed to any part of organizing and you want to see how it connects to the anti-racist work we're doing with the defund campaign, building towards abolition, please come out. You can register at bit.ly/defund4Aug20, so for August 20, bit.ly/defund4aug20.
Well, thank you for that. And just a reminder to the listeners that tomorrow is actually today, since this will be aired on Tuesday, August 4th. I want to thank you so much, Hind, Alex, and Tiffany, for joining us on Revolutions Per Minute. This is definitely both this eviction defense, which we think is going to be a really crucial front of struggle going forward this year and beyond, And the mutual aid networks you discussed, this defund NYPD campaign. We really want to keep our listeners updated on all of these fronts. So hopefully we'll be able to have you come back and give some updates on these struggles. But I just want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You are listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can also find us on our websites, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com or rednet.socialist.nyc. We're also on Twitter, at NYCRPM. Today, we've been talking about the struggle against the impending wave of evictions and its connections to the struggle against police brutality and fascism here in New York. Before we go on to our last interview, I just want to remind our listeners that this is the only station that you can hear this kind of information about these struggles happening. You're not going to hear it on the corporate media. So if you want to give a donation to the station, please call 516-620-3602. Again, that's 516-620-3602. Or go to WBAI.org and become a buddy of Revolutions Per Minute, where you get the content we're going to hear about the struggle against landlords, cops, and all sorts of capitalists and their sycophants. So now we are joined by Ginger. Ginger, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So we only got 5 or so minutes here, but we really wanted to make sure we shared your story with our listeners. So can you briefly describe your situation? How can our listeners show solidarity with your struggle, as well as the struggle of other tenants? And how can tenants build power in this moment through tactics like rent strikes and community defense against evictions?
Sure thing. So I've been a resident of Flatbush since December of 2018. And now I'm the sole official member of my chapter of my tenants association. So folks can Google Parkway Tenants Association, or they can find our link tree. Mine is 100 Woodruff Ave TA. And just to give people a little bit more context, on June 12th, my property manager broke into my apartment with a power drill. And this culminated after about 6 months of harassment and manipulation and threats.
So your place was literally broken into by your landlord, and he's physically trying to force you out in a certain sense.
Yeah. Sorry about that. My speaker going off. It wasn't meant for dramatic effect. But yes, yeah, so everybody can find my story on BK Reader, or they can find my story on Left Voice. I gave an interview for Left Voice. And they can also look at the concrete videos on my Instagram. My Instagram handle is Jing Duan. It's GINGDWAN. And to help people find their place in the movement, I strongly suggest people explore decolonization and re-indigenization and intersectional feminism.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing both the specific story that you're facing and also kind of bringing out these really important ideas of decolonization, intersectional feminism, something that we definitely like to talk about here on Revolutions Per Minute. And do you have any final thoughts you want to share with our listeners before we get off the air?
Yeah, absolutely. Just to remind everybody that the DNA of the United States of America is based on a profit over people equation. So we need to start dismantling this DNA by coming together and just having conversations. No matter how many mountains we want to move or like people we want to help through mutual aid, it starts with one conversation at a time. And just because you don't know how to do something isn't a reason to not do anything at all. And just remember that throughout history, the amount of oppressed people worldwide have overcome much harder adversity with less education, less community, less resources, and they still won. So even though their successes don't guarantee ours, we better try as hard as we can to do our due diligence and not give up by our own accord.
That is a perfect way to end our show. I couldn't put it better myself. We definitely need to be drawing on the historical struggles, seeing what we can learn from them. Moving forward, this is going to be a very difficult period, but it's also a great opportunity to build working class power, and the struggle of tenants is going to be key in this broader fight. So thank you so much for joining us, Ginger, and sharing your story with our listeners. And we will actually be off the air next week at 5. There's going to be a special here on WBAI, but we will be back the next Tuesday after that to be talking about both the NYC DSA convention as well as the plan to run city council candidates in 2021. So thank you to all of our guests and our listeners for tuning in. This is Revolutions Per Minute, and you'll hear from us on the airwaves and see us out on the streets. Thank you again.